This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, a preview of Iraqi elections. What's at stake for Iraq, the region, and the United States? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Iraqis head to the polls May 12 in the first national election since the defeat of the so-called Islamic State and the fifth parliamentary election since the fall of Saddam Hussein. At stake are 329 seats for the Council of Representatives, the political body that will be tasked with electing Iraq's president and prime minister. Despite assurances by Iraqi authorities of rigid security measures aimed at protecting the country's election centers, analysts say the upcoming election is unlikely to bring the kind of political stability many Iraqis desire. Analysts say incumbent Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi has a good chance of winning another term, but there could be other shifts in the balance of power in Baghdad. Middle East analyst Ellen Lapson, who was a recent guest on Press Conference USA, says that after last year's controversial independence referendum in northern Iraq's Kurdish region, the Kurdish bloc in parliament has lost some of its influence in Iraqi politics. She asserts when Sunni and Shiite politicians have been at odds, senior Kurdish figures have often been the buffer or source of compromise. Well, with us to discuss Iraqi elections, what's at stake for Iraqis in the region, are two distinguished regional analysts. Daniel Serwer is formerly a U.S. diplomat with the rank of minister counselor. He is currently a scholar at the Middle East Institute and professor and director of the Conflict Management Program at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. And Bilal Wahab, he's a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and that's a think tank here in Washington. He specializes in Iraq and governance in Kurdish areas. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
And Daniel Serwer, let me begin with you, because I'd like to start with the fact that the United States has withdrawn from the Iran nuclear agreement, to look at to what extent there is some kind of fallout for Iraq in particular, because some analysts say that the withdrawal from this Iran nuclear deal could affect the balance of power in the region, that Iran could be pushed into a more confrontational stance in Iraq as a result of U.S. withdrawal. What are your thoughts?
I think in the short term, the Iranians are going to make every effort to be seen as well-behaved, not only in Iraq, but also elsewhere. They want to keep the Europeans on board to implement the Iran nuclear deal so that they can gain the economic and financial benefits that they believe should flow from it. If that were to fail, then you might see them stiffening in many regional areas, making life much more difficult for the Americans. They were able to do that during the worst of the fighting in Iraq, and they could do it again if they really tried.
Turning to you, Bilal Wahab, it's no secret that Iran wields disproportionate influence in Iraq, has for many, many years now. But what is your reaction to the U.S. withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal? To what extent could that even, you know, strengthen their position in Iraq?
Unlike the United States, Iran has strategic patience in Iraq, and they have done long-term investments in the popular mobilization forces, known as militias, who have now united to enter Iraqi parliaments and compete for the top job position of the prime minister. The United States' favorite in this election is a second term for Prime Minister Abadi, who is less sectarian, who has reached out to the Sunni communities, who has made peace with the Kurds, and reached out to Iraq's Arab neighbors, Saudi Arabia, and in effect boosting the Iraqi national identity. The question is, how hard are the Shia militias and the popular mobilization forces that are close to Iran are going to act as spoilers, encouraged by the increasing tensions between the United States and Iran?
Back to you, Daniel Serwer, to take a look at what's at stake in these elections. Would you agree with the assessment of Ellen Lapson that I cited in my introduction? She says that quietly Iraq has been creating a more modern and representative political system. It's less sectarian. How do you see that reflected not only in the population, but in the parties that are contesting and the groupings and alliances?
There's no question. When I was in Iraq in December, all the politicians we talked to, Sunni, Shia, and Kurdish, were all looking for alliances across ethnic and sectarian lines because Iraqis want better governance, they want more technocratic governance, they want to hear less about sectarian and ethnic identity. So the sentiment is clearly there in the population pushing in the direction of better governance. Whether that will be reflected in the election results is another question, because there are really two elections in Iraq. One is of the representatives in the parliament, and then the parliament elects the president, the speaker, and the prime minister. It's in that second election that popular sentiment may mean much less than party identity, sectarian, and ethnic identity. Haider al-Abadi, if he repeats, that'll be a clear signal that Iraq is headed in a more nationalist direction. But there are other possibilities for Prime Minister. Hadi al-Amri is the most obvious one, who would be a clear signal of sectarian dominance in the future. So the jury's still out. This election really matters, and maybe that's the good news in Iraq.
Turning to you, Bilal, for your take on this evolution of the Iraqi polity, that people are actually looking across sectarian lines. How do you see that playing out in this election and then subsequently for the election within the parliament of the prime minister and president?
I agree with what Dan said and described the Iraqi political landscape shifting. Sectarianism and ethno-nationalism is still prevalent in Iraq and will play a factor in this election, but what is changing is factionalism within these communities. So, for example, in the past, the Kurdish parties will come together, create a mega Kurdish list, and compete against Arabs. But not this election, because just being Kurdish or being on a Kurdish list hasn't translated into good governance, services, and jobs for the Kurdish youth and citizens of Kurdistan. And this is true in the Sunni communities and the Shia communities. So what is different about this election is factionalism within these three components of Iraq. Now, probably it's too early in Iraq's democratic evolution for a Kurd to vote for an Arab or for a Sunni to vote for a Shia list. But within these communities, there is more demand for accountability, which in this election translates into more demand for diversity. The question for this election, this trend in the society, in the electorate, might not translate immediately to changes in the governance structure. However, it's definitely a step in the right direction in this democratic evolution that Iraq is going through. The fact that we have an election that its results is not known before the election is definitely something very unique by Middle Eastern standards.
Briefly, Daniel Serwer, what are the issues driving this election? What are priorities for the voters?
I think first for voters are the economic issues. This is the first moment in quite some time in Iraq when security wasn't the overriding issue. Iraqis are looking for jobs, they're looking for livelihoods, and they want to hear what politicians will do to provide those things. And that is a kind of normalization of Iraqi politics. It's extremely important.
Let me turn to you, Bilal Wahab, because in addition to jobs and perhaps reconstruction, you know, since the rout of the so-called Islamic State, what about corruption? Is that another concern of Iraqis? What else would you add to that list of priorities?
So corruption is a truly Iraqi problem. It's a Shia problem, a Sunni problem, and a Kurdish problem. And therefore, it is one of the main agendas of the parties that would like to present themselves as an alternative to the status quo. Corruption, unfortunately, in Iraq is rampant. It's political. It's deep. In some cities and provinces, it's also a social phenomenon. And that's why there is a revolt against it. Let me tell you about Iraq's most popular show. It's called the Al Bashir Show. It's political satire. Iraq is not ready for that kind of show to be aired in Iraq, so it airs out of Jordan. But nonetheless, it's a very powerful show in which the broadcaster grills politicians for their performance on air. And each show gets about, you know, millions of views over TV and social media. And that has become a voice for people's anger and resentment. And in reaction to this, many of the parties running in this election had to put lipstick on or change their names or reformulate their agendas. The quest for a civilian government, which is a code word for secular government, has forced some of the political parties to go from Islamic or sectarian or ethnic names into more governance-oriented names like victory, wisdom, instead of Kurdish, Islamic, or Sunni.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Daniel Serwer. He's professor and director of the Conflict Management Program at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and Bilal Wahab. He's a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, a think tank here in Washington. We're analyzing what's at stake in the Iraqi elections for both Iraq and the region. And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Nematula Asadi, who's an electrical engineer from Wardak, Afghanistan. And if you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com. Well, back to our guests and talking about the Iraqi elections, what's at stake. Daniel Serwer, I'd like to get your take on Sunni discontent, to what extent it continues. You know, they're a minority. They still seem to fear some Shia security forces who sort of lump them all together, fear that they are somehow secretly sympathizing with the Islamic State and others. What is their situation? And what about the so many displaced Iraqis? There's about 2.3 million displaced. Will they be able to vote?
With respect to the Sunnis, I think it's fair to say that they've been repeatedly traumatized. They were traumatized by the American invasion. They were traumatized by their own resistance to the American invasion. They were traumatized by the Islamic State. Many have come to understand that their fate depends on peace and stability and depends on their kicking out the radicals that have plagued Iraq in the past. I think it's not impossible that Haider al-Abadi will have a significant number of votes among Sunnis because he's regarded as the liberator of large Sunni areas. It's also fair to say that Iyad Alawi, who's running again, is a Shia, and he'll get a lot of Sunni votes as well. So there is going to be cross-sectarian voting. What will be interesting to watch is whoever wins can deliver to the Sunni community, because it's perfectly obvious from the outside that essential that Sunnis begin to feel included in Iraq. It's also essential that Kurds begin to feel included in Iraq. But that's not easy, especially when there are Shia who feel, well, we mobilized, we fought the Islamic State, we deserve the fruits of this victory. Bilal, maybe you're more able to answer than I am about displaced voting, but my understanding is that they can vote.
The Iraqi High Electoral Commission is taking ballot boxes to the camps where the internally displaced are positioned. And they also made some facilitations as to the availability of identity cards, because many of these people, when they fled, they lost their identification cards. So the government is trying hard to make voting possible. However, because many of these displaced people live in camps, the fear there is that they might be subject to coercion from whoever manages their camps, be it militias or be it the Kurdish government. And so that politics remains a challenge, but the mechanics of the election is being addressed.
And let's be specific. These internally displaced people were displaced mostly from areas where ISIS was prevalent. Is that correct? Like Mosul? And are they primarily Sunni Arabs, would you say, Daniel Serwer?
That's my understanding, that they are mostly Sunni Arab and mostly displaced in this last fighting with the Islamic State. But you also have Iraqis displaced from many other episodes in recent Iraqi history. There are a lot of issues concerning displacement and what caused it, and should people move back home? Should they be compensated? Those are big issues in Iraq.
And that's why one of the next challenges for stability in Iraq is going to be reconstruction and rebuilding of the towns and the cities that were under ISIS control, where they were destroyed in the process of liberating them from ISIS. The United States helped Iraq by convening a conference in Kuwait, whereby Iraq's neighbors and Western governments came together to pledge, not necessarily donations to the Iraqi government, but encouraging their private sector to invest in rebuilding these towns.
Back to you, Daniel Seward, to talk about the Kurdish areas. Of course, last year, the referendum vote, which didn't turn out in the Kurds' favor.
No, the vote occurred, won overwhelmingly, and then large contested areas were taken back from the Kurds by Iraqi security forces. So the event was seen as a failure for the Kurds, even though the referendum succeeded.
And how do you see their role? Have they lost some influence, as some analysts say? How do you see not only their role within Iraq, but in the northern region of Iraq where
As Bilal suggests, they are less unified than they have been for some decades. They were always historically divided, but they are less unified today than they've been for decades. They're not sure where they're headed any longer. I mean, they thought they were headed for an independent state. That failed. Now they have to content themselves with reintegration into Iraq. That involves financial issues, involves control of oil and oil exports, and it involves the relationship between governance in Erbil and governance in Baghdad. And those are all very difficult issues to sort out. I don't think you should discount the Kurds as a major factor, because the Shia will always be split. They're clearly split in the run-up to the elections. And one Shia force or another will come out with a lot of votes, maybe more votes than the others. But they won't have enough votes to govern without Kurds.
Bilal, this is your expertise. You're an Iraqi Kurd. And I'd like to get your take on the role of the Kurds since this referendum, which didn't go in the direction they wanted. How do you see their role within Iraqi Kurdistan and also Iraq in general?
Within Iraqi Kurdistan, factionalism has always been the bane of Kurdish politics, a power sharing that emerged in the mid-1990s between two main ruling parties in Kurdistan still lingers. However, when it comes to Kurds versus Arab Iraq and competing for maximizing Kurdish leverage in Baghdad, that has always united the Kurds, except for this election. And that denotes that the weakness of the Kurdish position, the shock of the repercussions of the independence referendum, whose failure from the Kurdish side, which was a military, political, and economic failure, was due to that internal factionalism and lack of state institutions within the Kurdish governance structure that made the Kurdish loss so painful. The aftermath of the referendum, where the Iraqi troops rolled back on areas that were under Kurdish control since 2014, was military loss because the Kurdish forces were overwhelmed by the Iraqi forces. It was economic loss because half of the oil exporting capacity that the Kurds controlled before was lost to the Iraqi government. And then from this was a political failure because Kurdish relations in Baghdad and Turkey and the United States did not result in pressuring Baghdad not to attack Kurdistan. So the Kurds are starting over. They know that they still have leverage in Iraq. According to the power-sharing norm, since 2005, Iraq has always had a Kurdish president. And Kurds have had members in parliament and some key ministerial positions. So the Kurds are starting over by competing in the national elections, hoping to get those key positions in Baghdad. They're trying to mend their relationships with the neighboring countries that they angered with the referendum. And they're also in the process of finding new patrons, since the United States seems to be preoccupied elsewhere, such as with Iran and North Korea. So as we speak, the Kurdish prime minister is actually in Russia in order to tighten the economic and energy in particular with Russia in the hope of finding another international patron and protector, because this was an episode of the Kurdish march toward independence. It's not the end.
Back to you, Daniel Serwer. Bilal mentioned that the president is always Kurdish, and this relates to the quota system, or the fact that the government in Iraq currently is based on a quota system with leadership positions designated to sections of the Iraqi public. The president is usually a Kurd, the prime minister is a Shia, and the speaker of parliament usually Sunni. What I want to ask you is, given now that there's this cross-sectarian alliances, is this perhaps becoming obsolete, or is there still a rationale for this type of a quota system in Iraq?
Only time will tell whether they maintain this system, which is not formalized. It's not written down in the Constitution. It's something the Americans initiated in Iraq after the invasion, and the Iraqis have found it convenient to maintain. But is there a possibility that there would be a Sunni prime minister and a Shia president? I think that possibility does exist. The negotiations over who gets which job normally in Iraq have occurred as a package. That is, the parliament meets and it has to choose a president, a speaker, and a prime minister. And those things are usually all negotiated together. So I do expect still to see some ethnic sectarian distribution. But there's no automaticity about its being a Kurdish president. But then the other jobs would move around as well. We'll see what happens.
And so, Bilal, do you have any thoughts about if it's time to reform the quota system? How do you see that? Is benefiting Iraq or not?
I described it as a norm. So, yes, it's not, unlike Lebanon, it's not coded into law. However, it has been a practice that resulted in and contributed to reinforcing politics in Iraq, which has become politics of patronage. These positions are very important for these components. That's why two offices, and they spent, by one estimate, over $1 billion that's spent in campaigning in this election. And the way that this works is that then for the next 4 years, these political parties will use the positions that they get in government in order to dole jobs and contracts and other perks to their supporters. And regardless of how this dynamic is going to shift, this patronage politics is going to persist in the absence of an active private sector that can create jobs. Iraqi economy, like other oil-dependent economies, is a rentier economy, which means that the government runs the show and the main employer and the main source of revenue and cash in the economy, and then whatever private sector exists, it's usually in the import sector rather than the manufacturing and the labor-intensive sector. So one of the challenges of the Iraqi government and the Kurdish government is creating jobs, and in the absence of that opportunity, politics become not only a way of gaining power, but a way of winning bread.
And as we close, Daniel Serwer, anything to add or subtract with regard to the economy, the importance of really generating jobs and revenue so that the reconstruction can take place? But what about the mechanics? What is the next step after the parliamentary elections? How long might it take for the parliament to choose these officials, form a government?
It can take weeks and even months. It can also be done in 24 hours. It all depends on the negotiations and how far they've been ripened even before the election. I want to add one other thing. One of the issues this new government is going to face is the presence of the Americans inside Iraq. And Americans should be thinking about that as well. But should they stay? Should they go? I think the inclination this time is for at least a substantial training and equipping mission to stay. But I'm not sure that the American public is entirely ready for that. But I think certainly in Congress and probably in the administration as well, there'll be an inclination to keep a couple of thousand there.
You get the last word, Bilal, with regard to next step and how you see this playing out in terms of how long it will take for the government to be formed.
Last time we had elections, it took a record time. I think it broke the Guinness World Record. That's why Iraq requires strategic patience from Washington, because this is a country where politics is normalizing in the sense that elections are unpredictable. We have new parties emerge and new trends, and the society is reacting to facts on the ground, and they're holding their governments and politicians accountable. And we have politicians that, despite all of their troubles, they are responding to these pressures from the public. Government formation is not a given. It's coalition, it's horse trading. Democracy is taking shape despite the variety and diversity of political views and ethno-national makeup of Iraq. Everyone is committed that the ballot box is the ultimate way of forming a government and sorting the differences. Despite having religious authorities, even the highest religious authority in Iraq has reiterated his support for the democratic process. So what Iraq needs is patience and best wishes.
Indeed, and on that cautiously optimistic note, that's about all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Daniel Serwer, professor and director of the Conflict Management Program at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and Bilal Wahab, fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your terrific insights.
pleased to be with you.
You're welcome.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guests. Our engineer was Joe Gill. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.